Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got the usual two segments lined up for today's show. First, in a few minutes, we'll speak with Michael Rose of the Bureau of National Affairs about their survey of a bunch of mostly Wall Street-type economists about what they're expecting for the U.S. economy and the global economy in the coming year, to get a read of what the consensus is. It's not that surprising, but we will get the details on that from Michael Rose in a few minutes. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with the Iranian-American political economist Cyrus Bina about events in Iran, which are heating up again. There are some people on the left who thought that the demonstrations after the election last June were a kind of manipulation produced by the CIA and George Soros and the usual suspects. Some of those folks think that Iran is somehow a bulwark against U.S. imperialism. Cyrus Bina dissents from all those views, so we will hear from him on what his view of what's been going on in Iran is all about. And before all that, some words in the news. So much for realignments. After the November 2008 election, triumphant Democrats reveled in the alleged destruction of the Republicans and extended their revelries for months afterwards. They're a little quieter now, especially the more liberal among them, as it became more impossible to deny Barack Obama's enthusiastic fealty to established power. Even so, if you flip on MSNBC on the average weekday night, that is, when they're not doing prison porn or entrapping pathetic losers who think they're flirting online with teenagers and not with cops, which is their normal weekend fare, you're treated to almost continuous assertion of the right's lunatic irrelevance. I'll grant the lunatic part, the American right is truly living in an insane world of its own creation these days. But irrelevance? I think not. Just this week, we heard of the imminent voluntary retirements of a number of senior Dem politicians. Preemptive retirements, that is, before the voters could send them off to the glue factory in about 10 months. They can read the writing on the wall. And there has been no leftish move on the part of the American body politic. That is, this is no realignment election that we're talking about. Gallup reported on Thursday that for the entire year of 2009, the share of the American population self-identifying as conservative hit 40%. The highest in the 17 years that they've been asking the question in its present form. That's almost twice as many as the 21% who self-identify as liberal, and a little higher than the 36% who identify as moderate. Admittedly, there are some problems with these self-identifications. You might get different answers if you asked very specific questions about very specific issues, but the trend is significant, as is the emotional valence of the labels. It's funny, though the right has been energized by fighting against Obama's phantasmic radical leftism, he is, of course, no such thing. But his very vagueness and slipperiness have come to haunt him. Since he stands for little other than compromises aimed at shoring up the status quo, his ranks of enthusiastic supporters shrink every day. He has more enemies and fewer friends all the time. This is what happens when you're a brand rather than someone with principles. Now a few words about the U.S. economy. I've just been looking at how the current recovery, weak and tentative as it is a recovery, how it stacks up against its cyclical ancestors. In a few words, more respectably than you might guess at first. The weakest aspect is, as I've been saying here for ages, the job market. It's turning. It's not turning like it did in the strong recoveries of 1975 and 1982, but it is turning. The biggest surprise is that manufacturing looks to be really picking up, more like it did in the stronger recoveries of the 1970s and 80s than in the weak ones of the early 90s and 2000s. We'll hear more about all this in a few minutes. Finally, Bloomberg, the news service, not the mayor, reported on Thursday that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, then led by our current Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, urged AIG to withhold details about its payments to banks during the depths of the financial crisis in late 2008. AIG had paid Goldman Sachs and other big banks 100 cents on the dollar on insurance contracts that the banks had taken out to cover mortgage securities that had turned sour. The government then paid AIG scores of billions to keep it from going under. The AIG rescue then turned out to be a covert bailout of the big banks. But it looks like the New York Fed wanted to hide that fact. Earlier, Bloomberg had reported the New York Fed pressured AIG into paying off the contracts in full rather than negotiating haircuts, as they say in the trade. For all this generosity and deviousness, Tim Geithner is promoted to Treasury Secretary, where he's been spending scores of billions doing Well, who knows exactly what?
And now a breaking news update, especially for the KPFA and podcast audiences. Friday morning brought the release of the U.S. employment report for December. November's report was something of a pleasant surprise, with job losses slowing to a crawl after almost 2 years of savage declines. December, while not a return to savagery, did show more losses than I'd expected or anyone wanted to see. As I always do when I discuss these monthly employment reports from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, I should say that they're based on two very large surveys, one of 300,000 employers, known as the Establishment or Payroll Survey, and another of 60,000 households, unsurprisingly known as the Household Survey. I know there are some reflexive skeptics in the audience who think that these things are all cooked, but I spend a good bit of my life studying this stuff, and I assure you that they're very well done by highly competent and serious people. Okay, now some details, starting with the Establishment Survey. Employers shed 85,000 jobs in December, with losses widely dispersed through economic sectors. Manufacturing and construction were hit hard, though there was a lot of unusually bad weather in the month that could have made things look worse than they really are in those sectors. Retail also fell, but finance and especially healthcare, that perennial gainer, added jobs. And temp firms, which often lead broader employment trends, continued their recent strength. Wage growth was very weak, with average hourly earnings up just a few pennies and the year-to-year change lagging inflation at just over 2%. Wage growth was nearly twice as strong as recently as a year ago. Taking a longer-term view, with the December numbers now in, we have a preliminary picture of the year that will change a bit with routine revisions in the coming months. In 2009, employment was off by 3.7%, the worst since 1938's minus 5.9%, that is, in the second phase of the Great Depression. Only 1945, the year of the World War II demobilization, comes close to 2009's losses at 3.6%. To paraphrase Richard Nixon, this truly has been a great recession. The household survey painted a darker picture than its establishment counterpart. The share of the adult population with a job fell by 0.3 percentage point to 58.2%, its lowest level since July 1983. There was also massive labor force withdrawal in December. Though the unemployment rate was unchanged at 10%, the ranks of the adult population classed as not in the labor force because they're not working or not actively looking for work experienced one of its biggest increases ever. Some of this may be statistical noise, but it's also likely that huge numbers of people have concluded that it's just not worth the time looking for jobs that don't exist, meaning that they're not counted in the official unemployment tally. The probability of a person unemployed in November finding a job in December rose slightly from the previous month, but at just over 21%, it's still near an all-time low. I should say that I picked up this technique for estimating the probability of finding a job from the economist Robert Shimer. So the trend I've been talking about here for many months continues. The rate of job loss continues to slow, but employers are still on a hiring strike. So while the labor market is no doubt stabilizing, it's still facing strong headwinds. They've slowed down from hurricane force to something more like 50 miles per hour, but they're a long way from turning themselves into a breeze at our backs. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about the outlook for 2010.
Now some of the song Spilled Oranges by the New Zealand band The Mad Scene, mid-90s indie pop, and it still sounds wonderful and fresh. We're now joined on the line by Michael Rose, who's with the Bureau of National Affairs, a information services company. I'm not sure exactly how they identify themselves, based in Washington, D.C. They recently did a survey of a number of economists to come up with the consensus 2010 economic outlook for the United States and the global economy, and thought it worth taking a survey of the landscape, what we might expect in the year ahead, since we had two not-so-good years just behind us. Welcome to Behind the News, Michael Rose.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
How does the Bureau of National Affairs identify itself exactly?
We're a provider of specialized news and information services for professionals in business and government primarily. The publication I work on is called Daily Labor Report. It's been around since the 1940s. And we're read by attorneys and folks at labor unions and people on the Hill and government officials and that type.
Okay, so you and your colleagues did a survey of about 30, mostly
yep.
Wall Street-type economists. Tell us exactly who got asked the questions.
We surveyed about 22 economists, and you're right, a number of them do come from investment banks, but we also have some from the academic world and a few from trade associations and a few sort of independent economic consulting types. And so we asked them about, their expectations for the coming year in terms of GDP and employment, the unemployment rate, and various other economic indicators.
All right. Well, let's start with the big macro picture and then focus
okay.
in on the labor market. This focused mostly on the U.S. economy, but there's also some questions about the outside world as well, right?
Well, the survey itself is focused on the U.S. economy, and then we sort of do an overview of the global picture also.
Yeah, so let's talk about the U.S. economy. It's
okay.
People are coming around to a consensus that the recession is probably over.
Right.
A lot of people thinking probably ended in June. That seems
right.
like a reasonable point of view to me.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, the recovery hasn't felt so great.
Right.
Are we going to see more of the same in 2010?
In the early parts of 2010, it's likely that we may. Although in terms of the employment picture, at least the consensus was that a per month average of around 70,000, 71,000 jobs might be added per month in the first half of the year. We did have a sprinkling of panel members in our survey who predicted continued employment decline. So as you know, the most recent employment numbers we have were for November when we saw a decline of 11,000 jobs. And that came as something of a welcome surprise because it was such a small figure. We sort of had a range, and we had some people who are forecasting a decline of somewhere around 50,000 jobs per month on average, and ranging all the way up to adding, over 200,000 jobs per month on average in the first half. So it was really kind of a range of opinions.
What are they looking for in general in, growth, GDP, which is the driver?
GDP, we're looking for first quarter growth averaging growth around 2.9%. And then for the whole year, fourth quarter 2009 to fourth quarter 2010, about 3%. So, those were pretty stable numbers across the board in terms of people's forecasts.
So that's a respectable number, but hardly gangbusters.
That's true. That's about right.
And how much of this growth is coming from the massive amounts of fiscal and monetary stimulus, and how much of it is kind of self-generated by usual economic forces?
I think there's a general consensus among economists that the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, better known as the stimulus package, really did actually do some good in terms of not having employment decline as much as it could have. So I think that that you're sort of hearing rumblings on Capitol Hill of what's alternatively called either a second stimulus or a jobs package. We didn't ask specifically about that in our survey. But it's certainly a possibility that some people did take that into account. So that could have some help, too, although it's not nearly as sure a thing as when we did the survey last year and everybody was counting on as soon as Obama took office there would be a stimulus package, if you know what I mean.
And, of course, the stimulus spending is structured, so it will continue throughout 2010. It's not
right.
a one-time injection in 2009. So
that's right.
The stimulus is not going to be withdrawn imminently. It's going to keep boosting things.
Yep, that's right. And the administration, keeps harping on that point that, it's still going. We're still seeing the effects of it. So they are saying that, it's too early to sort of judge how well the total Recovery Act has done.
What do the economists see as the state of household finances? People are, the usual lines are people are pretty tapped out. The housing market looks to be stabilizing, but it's not really taking off. So what are they seeing for the consumer?
It was also kind of a range. A lot of it was dependent on, if an economist thought that employment was not going to pick up till later in the year, then they also probably thought that personal consumption, consumer spending was also probably not going to pick up till later in the year. But basically, the consensus was for, real or inflation-adjusted personal consumption, consumer spending from fourth quarter 2009 to fourth quarter 2010 to be around 2.1%. That's also, as you might say, not gangbusters, but it's some sort of picking up. We're already hearing a few sort of positive signs from the holiday shopping season. People are saying it was maybe a little bit better than last year, so that's also something to keep an eye on.
But this is a change from recent history. This number for consumer spending is less than GDP growth, which means that consumption would be a smaller share of the economy by the end of this year.
Right.
That's a contrast with previous years when consumption grew more quickly. So is this some sort of significant structural transformation of the U.S. economy that's underway? People are just going to be a little more prudent and spend less recklessly?
That is what a lot of people are saying. People are sort of, there's a lot of wait and see going on. There's wait and see in terms of businesses waiting to see if they're going to hire workers. There's wait and see on consumer households part of, whether they're going to spend, whether they're going to buy a new car, a new home, new appliances. Some of the economists we talked to are still, forecasting for home foreclosures to continue throughout the year, and that can certainly put a damper on things. So, it's really there's a lot of sort of wait and see going on.
Yeah, and do they see recovery in the housing market, or still kind of stumbling along?
That was also kind of a mixed bag. Probably some improvement, but maybe not as much as might be hoped.
Now, was there a wide agreement among the economists? I mean, or it was a pretty narrow band of forecasts, or were they all over the place?
They kind of were all over the place, especially in terms of employment. A lot of people, a lot of the economists we talked to did factor in hiring for the census into their forecast for the first half. The Census Bureau is going to be hiring a lot of temporary workers, and that will probably affect the numbers in some way.
Those are fairly big numbers in the spring. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Every 10 years, they get that pop.
So the group who had actually the highest total monthly average employment figure for the first half, put in their survey form that they sent to us that was due to census hiring. So, there's not a lot of we can't really predict. But then at the same time, I talked to somebody else who said, the census, that's a temporary effect, so that'll be the case for 2 months, and then it'll go back to being kind of a sluggish slog forward.
And how worried were the economists about the state of federal government finances? The federal government is borrowing a ton of money and will continue to do so for a while. Is this something they were worried about?
We didn't really ask about that, aside from people are predicting the budget deficit in fiscal year 2010 to be minus about $1.3 billion, sorry, $1.3 trillion. So that was there was a consensus about that,
which is an enormous number.
It is an enormous number.
I guess if anybody can get away with that, it's the U.S. government, but we shall see.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Michael Rose, who is with the Bureau of National Affairs, and specifically their daily labor report. So let's start talking about the job market. I mean, it looks like we're going to see a stronger recovery in some of the headline indicators in GDP than we are going to see in employment. Is a broad agreement on that, wouldn't you say?
I would say that, the standard line you hear about recessions is that the labor markets lag the overall recovery. So because, of course, we are, most economists kind of agree that the recession is over and we're starting to pick up growth again, the labor market is lagging right now. And there's not a consensus by any stretch of the imagination of when the labor market will pick up.
And of the 23 economists you surveyed, 5 are actually expecting employment declines in the first half of the year. So
that's right.
No turnaround till mid-year.
That's right.
But most are expecting some kind of turnaround sometime early this year.
We didn't have any of the folks we surveyed predict employment declines in the second half. So hopefully by then, we'll be seeing some stronger gains, although it certainly remains to be seen, to what degree those gains will be.
And this is a bit of a sinister question, but how were their forecasts in the past? Do these guys have a good track record?
You know, it's been mixed. I have to admit that I've only worked here for about 2 years, so I worked on last year's forecast and not before that. But last year, I do know that the average unemployment rate that they predicted was only in the about 7 or 8% range for the year, and then obviously we're already up to 10.1, or 10% now. So it really varies. You know, a lot of the economists we survey participate in a lot of surveys. A lot of them participate in the blue chip survey, which is a well regarded indicator. So, these are folks who generally know what they're talking about, I think.
Yeah, it's a very, very difficult thing to predict.
It is.
What's going on. We're talking about, what you're talking about is the consensus is somewhere for less than 100,000 jobs a month in the first part of the year and somewhat more in the second part of the year.
Right.
That's really not enough to bring down the unemployment rate significantly, is it?
Not significantly, no. The unemployment rate forecasts, we had an average of about 10.2% in the first half per month, and then only dropping down to 9.9% in the second half, which, as you know, is not that much lower than what it is at now.
And we also saw a lot of labor force withdrawal in the recession. We have the lowest share of the adult population working since the early 1980s.
Right.
Is that going to turn around anytime soon, or is this a real long-term demographic shift? And is the aging of the baby boomers really starting to show up in the labor markets along with these kinds of business cycle issues?
You know, it really depends. We didn't ask specifically about that. But one thing that I can tell you, I did talk to one of our experts who said that a lot of the unemployment rate forecasts really depend on how many folks return to the labor market, because I don't know if, as you know, the employment figures from the Bureau of Labor Statistics only count folks who are in what they call in the labor force, which means you're either working or looking for a job. And so many people have become discouraged during the recession that they, you know, have stopped looking for work. So if more people, if more people start looking for work, but there are no jobs, that's gonna be a drag on the unemployment rate.
Yeah, so I guess discouragement is an important factor in just how high the unemployment rate is going to remain.
Right.
The productivity during this recession has been remarkably strong. So employers have been quick to fire, very slow to hire, and they've been squeezing the remaining workers pretty hard. Is that trend likely to continue?
Well, that's another thing that the panel members really differed on. I talked to one economist who said that, employers just can't sustain these productivity gains any longer without hiring workers. And he was really calling for, employment to grow sooner rather than later. It really depends on who you talk to, whether employers are stretched to the limit and they're going to have to hire workers, or whether they can keep working folks even harder, and becoming even more productive.
Well, they've also not been investing very much. I mean, this is really just working people harder. It's not like the late 90s when they were investing in high-tech stuff, and that was contributing to the productivity. That was just all they're not investing much at all in just making people do two jobs instead of one.
If you talk to, say, some labor unions about that, they would say, we need to improve access to capital for small businesses so they can make investments in their business and they can, invest in new technologies and hire workers. So that's also an issue.
What about wages? They've certainly not been growing very rapidly for the people who still have employment. You at the BNA do a wage trend indicator. What's that looking like?
That's right.
Tell us what is that wage trend indicator first. I've always been curious about how that's computed and what it's telling us.
The wage trend indicator is a composite number that takes into account a bunch of different indicators, including a survey we do here at BNA that is an employment outlook for each month. It also takes into account industrial production figures and a few other things. But basically, the wage trend indicator it's forward looking, so it tells us what is likely to happen in the coming months. And for quite a while now, it's been forecasting that the rate of wage growth is going to continue to be slow. So, we're not looking for major pickups in wage gains in the coming year. And that's just due to a variety of factors. That's not going to pick up until the overall economy and employment really pick up.
So it's just the labor market is so slack that employers don't need to pay higher wages.
That's that that might be a logical conclusion.
And also, workers are not in a position to demand higher wages either, so this is, I guess, a recipe for sluggish wage growth. Is there anything that could turn these things around that anyone sees, or is this pretty much baked in the cake for a while?
Well, you know, there's been a lot. There's been a bunch of policy prescriptions that have been discussed. You know, in early December, President Obama had his jobs summit, and I listened into, you know, a bunch of those sessions, and you had folks from you know, economists talking about everything from directing money directly to state and local governments so they could put people directly to work, you know, on infrastructure projects, put people in parks. You know, there was one economist who said something like, you know, have the government put people to work like FDR did. And then there were other folks who were talking about a job creation tax credit that would, you know, reward small businesses by lowering their taxes so they would be able to afford to hire more people. So there's a lot sort of ideas floating around out there, and you know, it's sort of we're waiting to see what the administration and Congress are going to do in terms of adopting any of those.
What about the outside world? Do we see stronger economies abroad in the coming year?
You know, I think it's going to be slow all over the place. And to be honest, my expertise is really in U.S. policy, so I'm not as well versed in the global picture. But you know, I think that there's a lot of issues with trade. There's a lot of issues with trade with China in particular. You know, you see that with the labor unions, particularly the United Steelworkers, that you know, successfully petitioned for the administration to impose a tariff on things like tires from China, which they believe is gonna you know, have an effect on the manufacturing sector here and employment here. So you know, it's you know, we got to wait and see what happens, but you know, it's probably going to be slow all around.
And there's also been a lot of talk on Wall Street about what it's going to look like, or when it's going to start happening. When is the Fed going to start withdrawing some of the stimulus that it's been injecting into the economy for the last couple of years? What are the thoughts in the economists in your survey about Fed policy in the coming months?
Well, we did ask our panelists about what they believed how they believed the Fed would raise rates, or what the federal funds rate target would be at the end of 2010. The consensus was about 0.75%. You know, as you know, it's very low right now. It's around zero. So you know, it's not going to be real significant likely. But you know, that's something else that there's a lot of uncertainty about.
So, and there's also a lot of anxiety about federal finances and some you know, people who want to cut spending, but it seems
right.
Like the economy is maybe not strong enough to stand the withdrawal of stimulus
right.
in the immediate future.
Right.
Well, I guess it's nice news that the recession is over, but on the other hand, it's not so nice news that the recovery is not going to feel very dynamic. And
yeah, it's going to be a slog, but you know, there's some light at the end of the tunnel, even if the light is not particularly bright right now. But you know, hopefully, if not this year, then in the years to come, you know, we'll see what happens. But it's going to be slow.
All right. Well, that sounds pretty reasonable to me, but not very cheering. All
yeah.
right, thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Michael Rose, who's with the Bureau of National Affairs and who worked on their survey of 20 or so economists on what they're expecting in the coming year. And as you heard, it's not very exciting. At least it's not further decline, although some of the economists thought there could be a possibility of a double dip or a relapse or something like that. But the consensus seems to be that it's going to be a weak recovery and will feel a lot like a recession to many, many people. And I have to say I agree with that, although there's something a little strange about the kind of consensus that's developed around this. When consensus is developed, you always want to question them and wonder if maybe you're missing something, that things could either be worse or better than this mediocrity everyone is expecting. Okay, let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about Iran. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Thank you. And that, some of the 26th of Bach's Goldberg Variations, performed by Andras Schiff. And we're now joined by Cyrus Bina, who teaches economics at University of Minnesota in Morris, is it, Cyrus?
Yes. Hi, Doug.
Welcome to Behind the News.
Oh, hi, yeah.
And so the it looks like the some of the rebellion against the Iranian government is heating up again in recent days. It seemed to have quieted down for a while, and things are heating up again.
Yes.
What's going on right now?
This is a sustained development since the election, the defrauded election by Ahmadinejad Khamenei. I think some people thought that the election is over, and of course there is some commotions and everything else is going to go back to the normal. Few of us thought that this is not so. Some of us observing Iran for more than 30 years, we believe that it has been the result of the two concentric circles, if you will, of a struggle which has been going on in Iran for a long time. One of which is within the regime itself, and we see that the coup d'etat, political coup d'etat, which was conducted, even anticipated and then conducted after the election so swiftly against the many founding fathers of the Islamic Republic by a very narrow margin of the elements within the regime itself. And, of course, that backfired. And so far we see the result of it time and time again. When there is a sort of commemoration of something, then the masses are coming. And, of course, the opposition, which is bulging by the day, coming to the fore.
The government used a considerable amount of force to try to repress the protests, right?
Yes, absolutely. And, of course, the reason is this, that this is not just the commotion within the regime itself, but the other one is between the regime and the entire population, which is composed of many classes, from the working class to the well-to-do classes all around. They are against the regime, and at least against this narrow part of the regime. Of course, we know that there are some supporters on the Green Movement of Mousavi and others and so forth, but that, of course, is because of the commotion or concentration of the force by the government against anybody who is raising any issue, then, of course, uniting everybody altogether.
I want to talk about the compositions of the resistance to the government in a bit, but what is the social base of what you call this Ahmadinejad Khamenei axis? Who do they represent exactly in the population?
Yeah. This is very important. Of course, I have written a paper, as well as I have written a paper also on the issue which was raised in the United States on the issue of incarceration of one of the professors in Cambridge, Gates, Professor Gates, and the police. This is, for the left at least, it should be understood that when somebody is from downtrodden section of the population and represents a particular regime, then you don't really talk or call or identify that individual as working class. So therefore, Ahmadinejad is in the same group. In other words, regardless of his background, Ahmadinejad is representing the government of Iran. But CGs are the face of the regime itself, rather than one, you know, if one wants to go back to the background of each one of them, there are various backgrounds altogether. So in this sense, the analysis which go back to the decomposition and then look at every individual and the background and they call them working class and so forth would be wrong. And that's why some of the left, one very huge part of the left, which of course helped this government about 30 years ago when it came to power, really raised the issue on that basis. And at the same time, on the basis that the other elements within the opposition are neoliberals. They are not neoliberals. Ahmadinejad has done all kinds of policies, implemented all kinds of policies, which were altogether more neoliberal than Rafsanjani and Khatami combined.
But the common view among some of the sympathizers in the Western left is that Ahmadinejad, as you allude to, Ahmadinejad represents the authentic working class, especially the rural working class of Iran, and that the opposition is just a bunch of fancy upscale cosmopolitans from North Tehran.
That's not true. If you look at the first demonstration, which was conducted on the 15th of, if you remember, 15th of June, almost 2.5 days or 3 days after the result of the election was announced, you see that from the South Tehran, very south, deep South Tehran, which is the working class elements, to the very north, 3 million people, or maybe more, came to demonstrate against us. Composed of old, young, from all kinds of backgrounds, from the working class background, from the well-to-do background, petty bourgeoisie, women, all ages and so forth. So when one look at one country and one city, look at it, Tehran. Tehran is about 12 million or so. But how many, if somebody wants to say that this is a middle class or well-to-do class, how many cities in the country, which is not exactly like New York, you know, the city of Tehran is not exactly like New York. Could you find, let me ask you, Doug, can you find 3 million people, very well-to-do people in New York?
I don't think you can find
3 million people in New York. 3 million people are well-to-do, which are supporting the Western, you know, for instance, the welfare revolution, quote-unquote, coming out in Tehran. This is not the true picture of what happened. The true picture of that is that the left has a cliche. Talks imperialism and anti-imperialism. And then bring it from his own or her own, you know, hat, and then tries to analyze them rather than going to the case concretely, case by case, and analyze the situation. This is what the left is really out to lunch, in my judgment.
I do want to talk about this issue because it's important to understand your view of Iran. You criticize in this paper you're talking about the standard view of many on the on the Western left that is pretty much drawn from Lenin's imperialism, that the world is divided by competing imperial powers, and that the top dog would be the United States, and it's calling the shots, and that that Iran plays the role of anti-imperialist in this kind of imaginary model. You really have no patience with that view of the world, right?
No. I think this is a wrong view. It is not to say that this view is wrong, is not to say that Lenin was wrong. Lenin was right. But this particular view relates to a particular period of history. And then Lenin was very concretely and rightly so, formulating the theory of imperialism not as a policy, as we know, but as a system itself. And then Lenin identified many conditions, including colonialism, including the trusts and the monopolies and so forth, division of the world among monopolies. And, of course, oil is a very important prima facie case in this case that I've worked very much on it. And, of course, division among the imperial powers. Now, you cannot separate all these conditions from each other. You cannot decompose it, as the econometricians may say that. They are all together, they are cumulative, and they belong to one particular era. Now, after 1970s, when we talk about the era of globalization, I'm not talking about corporate globalization and all these neoliberal policies and so forth. Globalization is an era. Neoliberal policies are policies, obviously. And, of course, that is maybe they are coincided with each other. But this is a different era. The era itself indicates that the monopolies in the form of what Lenin was rightly talking about is gone. This is not a monopoly. Concentration and centralization of capital is not monopoly defined by the bourgeois theory, as Marx argued a long time ago. This concentration and centralization should lead to the theory of competition based on a Marxian analysis, which, of course, the theory of value would be as a, you know, theory of pricing as well as theory of class formation, class polarization, and with other dimensions is ruling the world. Now, that's the meaning of globalization. Now, if you are dealing with this particular foundation, and then, of course, at the same time, you see that the early 1970s, the essential pillars of the Pax Americana, which, of course, the U.S. was its hegemon. And then when one looks at the hegemon and hegemony, we see that the hegemony is a particularity of a particular system. When the system falls, then the hegemon doesn't have any coronet to put on the head. It is not a king, in other words, and hegemony is gone. And, of course, hegemony is different from domination. In other words, going to the countries by force and engaging in the war. And the reason why the United States is having defeat after defeat in Iraq, in Afghanistan, if they will have in Pakistan, I anticipate that anywhere they go, they will have a defeat, is that this is not their time. This is not their epoch. They belong to the pre-Pax Americana. So in this particular sense, we don't have such things as anti-imperialists in this case. Even though the situation or conduct of the United States is worse than really, to some extent, from the regular imperialist conduct. Nevertheless, this is not the time that supports that. So in this case, we don't have any anti-imperialists, particularly Ahmadinejad.
I speak with Cyrus Bina, who is a professor of economics at the University of Minnesota at Morris, and a long-term analyst of both oil market and Iran and Middle Eastern politics. And I want to then now talk a little bit about the invasion of Iraq by your analysis. There's a standard analysis that was all about oil, the control of oil, and that's what the United States was lusting for. You don't concur with that analysis either, right?
No, Doug, you have been an observer of this from a long, long time, you know, and of course you yourself are very keen on the Wall Street and other stuff, which are really coming to the fore, and that's different from, let's say, previous decades and, of course, the eras and so forth. Oil is globalized through the crisis of 1973-74, which, of course, is identified by the bourgeois theory and the textbooks and the newspapers and so forth and so forth, the establishment as the OPEC year or OPEC era is not the OPEC era. OPEC was instrumental because OPEC was the institution of the rent collecting. And rent is one element, very legitimate elements of the theory of oil. And, of course, we have globalization based on decartelization of oil, which, of course, put an end to the international petroleum cartel, which was developed, put together, and, of course, organized in 1921 in Achnacarry, Scotland, and, of course, died in 1972, just shortly before the crisis here. So globalization, that was a crisis of globalization. Means what? Means that the oil, which is the most concentrated by any account, the most concentrated and centralized sector of the economy is globalized and also is operating based on competition. What competition? Not a textbook competition of the classical economics, which is a fictional competition, but the real competition formulated by Marx and supported by Schumpeter, by the way, that this competition leads to further concentration and centralization of capital. And it is not operating at the margins. It's at the center of production altogether. Therefore, if this is the case, then nobody or no element or no entity can control the price of oil. And we have seen it time and time again that they promised, and they talked about that, and then Saudi Prince Banda talked about that during the Bush administration. They could not do anything about it.
Parenthetically, I'd note that the contracts that the Iraqi government has handed out in recent months for development of Iraq oil resources have gone mostly to non-U.S. companies. So if the Bush administration hoped to get their hands on Iraq's oil, they have not succeeded in doing so.
Yes, sir. That's exactly true.
You have been arguing, and let's just bring this out explicitly, that the era of U.S. domination of the world has been over for several decades, and that the U.S. attempts to recover that domination through various military adventures prove really its desperation, not its power, right?
Yes. I beg to differ just in one definition. I didn't say domination. Domination could be by any means, including military.
Yes.
This is hegemony, which is somewhat, I'm following what the basis of hegemony from Gramsci's point is all about. And then, of course, adding 5 points to it simultaneously. So hegemony is different from the outright domination. Hegemony means that the system is really supported by the epoch, which is existing within that epoch. And therefore, Pax Americana was somewhat legitimate with its own era, even though it was illegitimate, we know, because of the conduct of many coup d'etats and so forth, including 1953 in Iran, unjustly and justifiably and so forth, but within its own system. But beyond that, when Pax Americana was imploded and has fallen altogether, the United States is a standalone entity altogether. Standalone doesn't mean that they don't talk to each other, join with Europeans or Japanese and so forth and so on, negotiate with Chinese. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about in a structured sense. So in this particular sense, it becomes more powerful as an entity, militarily, technologically, and so forth, but the actions of the United States government doesn't belong to this era, because this era is not the era of hegemony. Hegemony is gone. Therefore, they think, and this is ironic, that one wants to gain the hegemony by something which is exactly opposite of the hegemony, by going and invading countries. And, of course, it backfired. It will backfire from here to eternity. There would be no success to that.
But a lot of people in the U.S. power elite and some of their friends in Israel are talking about taking military action against Iran. What do you think the results of that might be if they actually were so stupid as to do that?
Yes. I think during the Cheney-Bush administration, I put Cheney one up because I thought he's the president of the United States. But anyway, during that time, it was very much likely to do so. But now I think the United States is getting wiser a little bit, perhaps, at least strategically. You know, action against Iran, first of all, military action would backfire. They're going to go after the bomb anyway, because that would persuade them further and further, no matter this government or a nationalist government or even a leftist government, if you will. You know, they would go after it. Any rational individual or group of people in the government, they know that they don't have any security. They go after it. This is one. So that backfire would be strategic. Now, maybe a gain here or there tactically, but it's strategic. Second of all, the question of sanctions. I have elaborated in this paper that these continuous sanctions created a condition that the economy under the guard, which was the Revolutionary Guard in Iran, which was very powerful and organized, they took care of the economy because of the sanctions and because of the limitations and so forth, and they legitimized themselves within the regime itself, if not in the eyes of the population, and took over the economy. Now they are taking care, over of poverty, take care of judiciary, every ramification of the country. So this is, I call it paramilitarization of Iran. And that, of course, conditioned on the Iran-Iraq war on the one hand, as a basis, and then, of course, the operation of sanctions. That's why, and of course, the sanctions themselves are very hard on the population. Now, I have talked to many from many groups in Iran, and those who came here and those who are back there and so forth, everybody is against sanctions, except few groups of the exilees here from the former regime, from the ancient regime of the Shah, as well as those who are connected to the neocons and Israeli government.
It sounds like what you're describing is that the power structure in Iran is a corrupt military oligarchy that's running things for its own advantage and not doing it very well.
Yes, certainly. I think this is a qualitative difference with the time that Khomeini was in charge, or at least he was as a guru guiding the whole thing prior to the end of the Iran-Iraq war. Khomeini himself said, and I'm paraphrasing it in translation, that don't let these guards take over the economy or politics. Don't let them come in. We have to decide about that on principles, our principles. And he was very, very much worried about that. And he was right, of course.
So what about the Iranian economy now? Is there much to it besides oil? Is there any kind of industry? What's the economic structure look like?
Yes. There was an encyclopedia of Iran Today came out in late last year, 2008, by two authors, of course, organized these things, and of course, Greenwood Press published that. I have four entries in that. Based on my observation, I think Iranian economy altogether is oil-based, one way or the other. And even if it would have been oil-based with more products from oil to be refined inside the country, to be processed, to be used, and so forth, then even though that is also a dependency to some extent on a particular resource, it would have been a little bit more acceptable. But Iran is importing their gasoline, 45% to 50% of the gasoline from outside of the country. And, of course, most of the oil extracted from Iran is being consumed inside the country very inefficiently as well. So one has to look at two sides of the economy. One, the foreign exchange earnings of the economy, which is basically oil-based. And second is the level of industrial development and proliferation to other industries, which is very minimal. It doesn't mean that Iran, when I said that, having said that, I would argue also that there is some certain level of industrial development in other industries. But compared with oil, really, it looks pale.
Now, that sounds like the classic social structure of an oil-exporting country, a rather thin elite that pockets the export revenues and not much else for the mass of the population to live on.
Right. This is called rentier states, actually, yes. But, you see, one has to also go concretely focus on Iran or any other case like Saudi Arabia and so forth. Because these generalized theories may not really respond, like Dutch disease arguments, like even generalization of rent theory would not do that. It's rent theory, basically, because we're talking about oil, we have to talk about rent. It's a concrete theory. Therefore, one has to go back and concretely develop it. And therefore, based on my observation and my analysis, I think, still we can call Iran a rentier state.
And so let's return to where we started, the protests and the rebellion against this current regime. Obviously, they're not burning out. They obviously have some social power. And where do you think it's going to go? Is this regime going to survive?
I think this regime will not, regime in the sense of representation by Ahmadinejad Khamenei, would not survive. And that is, in my sense, 99.999% they are finished. Whether the regime as a whole is finished, which I think it is finished, it depends on their struggle. And of course, we have the other very huge opposition, which are varied in an ideological sense. And of course, there is a huge struggle on the basis of, for instance, Green Movement, which doesn't have any direction, that the leaders like Mousavi and others would not really dare to depart from the previous policies of their administration during the Khomeini's time and so forth. And therefore, Green would be in a very bad position altogether. The Green itself, which is a very major thing, the Green Movement, we will be in the near future, very, very soon, we'll see that there is a fork in the road. And none of these sides or forks would go to Islamic Republic.
So do you think that Iran is moving towards some renunciation of the theocratic elements of the state and moving towards a more secular structure?
I think so. This is a tendency, and the movements, every movement, even within the Green Movement, would tell us from the masses. As, of course, a sample that I already did for myself in New York in September 23rd, when Ahmadinejad came here, talked to everybody, the youth movement and everything else. I think this is my sense.
Is this going to happen quickly, or is this something that's going to evolve over the course of months and years?
It depends. It all depends. Of course, as you know, it's not a big deal to say all it depends. But the question is this: the movement, and of course, the masses, and then transformations, and so on. The internal conditions and reaction of the government itself, which now they are gearing up for beating the people more and more. They imported the armored cars, which are also crowd control cars from China. They just, about 1 week ago, they had many, many units, of these prepared to confront the crowd and so forth. And they have engaged in torture and all kinds of shock ties and so on. So far, did not pay off. So the question is this, and of course, from the midsummer to the present time, this is not going to go away. And then the Iranian government is not functional anymore. So many of those people who were on the side of Ahmadinejad, they resigned and took off already. Two of them today. The ambassador of Iran in Oslo resigned yesterday, and so forth. So you see that the deja vu of the Shah in 1978-79 is coming to the fore.
All right, we have to close there. Thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Cyrus Bina, who teaches economics at the University of Minnesota in Morris. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. Let's go out with this, a little Australian hip-hop, of all things, from a very multicultural assembly called The Curse of Dialect. Contains many of the ethnic groups of Australia, along with some of their Asian neighbors invited as guests. This is from their song, Identity. Till next week. Bye.
In the center of the circle, suffers a tradition. Unified pre-dance, expanded expanse, expensive tension. Comprehend apprehension, government's attention. Practice and original roots, legion of doom. White Australia policy, where's Australian apology? Fallacy monopoly, trilogy of killing sprees. Let's revive, review, renew. Relevant pamphlet, can shoot, construct. I'm stuck in a political rut. I shut, they pronounce my name and announce my shame as they bounce the blame across the racist claims. Afraid of my unedited, epic, ethnic, mountain frame. Demanding that they hear it, the language of the spirit. Standing in the corridor, worried for